Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
To the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. Thank you.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Interdependence podcast. We're thrilled today to bring you a conversation with Professor Amy C. Beal of UC Santa Cruz. Holly and I have wanted to chat to Amy for about a decade now, after reading excerpts from her very difficult to get book, New Music, New Allies, American Experimental Music in West Germany, From the Zero Hour to Reunification. This book is kind of a unicorn. It outlines the pivotal impact that German state-funded institutions played in the development of American experimental music, from figures like John Cage and Morton Feldman, and pioneers across jazz and improvised music. This is a pretty wide discussion. We discuss some fun stuff, like State Department-funded jazz tours throughout Europe, speculations on potential CIA involvement in soft power arts initiatives in Germany and throughout Europe at the time. And perhaps most importantly, and most relevant to a present day context, we look at both the influence that this European state support may have had on music generally, and speculate on how, in a COVID paradigm, we have to acknowledge the complications and responsibilities inherent to European state and market support, or in some cases, lack of support, of American musics in a time where those asymmetries and support nets appear to sadly be expanding rather than contracting. We also end up touching on an unexpected but worthy thread on how little support there was for female composers amongst the American avant-garde, so little at times that it appeared to be bordering on sabotage. This is, I think, a really cool episode with a deeply, deeply researched guest. And I hope that the threads that we're seeing with her research, even though some of it might seem like it happened a long time ago, are as easy to connect to the present as perhaps we find them. So thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Bring, 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 bring. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Amy.
Hi, guys.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
So it's so nice to have you here with us today. I was hoping that you would introduce yourself to our dear listeners.
Well, my name is Amy Beal, and I am a music historian and a pianist, and I teach at the University of California in Santa Cruz.
Wonderful. So Matt and I have been wanting to talk to you, I think Matt was saying before, for like a decade almost. We came across your book, New Music, New Allies, which documents this really unique relationship between West German patronage and many of the prominent American composers post-war, from Cage to Lamont Young to David Tudor. So I was hoping that just to kind of like kick off this episode, you could give us a brief overview of this text. I know it's a very in-depth research text, and so it's a lot to ask to kind of give an overview. But if you could just introduce us to that work a little bit so that we could talk about it.
Okay. Can I do that by way of explaining how I came about to doing it in the first place?
I think that would be amazing.
Of course. That's a great idea. Yeah.
Okay. It's not necessarily a short answer.
That's great.
So I first went to Germany in, 1984, 1985 as an exchange student. It was a junior year abroad, and I ended up in a small town in the Schwäbische Alb near Stuttgart, where I lived with a family for a year. Mm-hmm. I learned German during that time. I was a pianist as a kid, and so I loved, you know, the idea of being in Europe and in Germany in particular because of the musical history. And I ended up, then I came back to the States, finished high school, and I went to college and I majored, I was a piano major, and I did a BM in piano. And then after I finished, I started a master's program. And the first year of my master's program, I did another year in Germany where I ended up in Mainz at the university in Mainz. And because of mm-hmm. the situation with the way the music program worked with the university, I ended up not doing as much piano as I had expected and sort of drifted towards music history a little bit. But one of the most significant things that happened during that time was, since Mainz is very close to Frankfurt, and Frankfurt was really a center for contemporary music in a lot of different ways with the Hessischer Rundfunk activities and being close to Darmstadt and all that stuff. During that year, I became exposed to a lot of contemporary music I hadn't ever encountered as a music major in the United States. Among other things, I saw Stockhausen doing things in Frankfurt and other things. And I also sort of became aware of American experimental music really for the first time during that time. So by the time I went back to the States to finish my master's in piano, I was sort of drifting away from the classical world of piano music and more into this interesting contemporary music and experimental music. So I went back to Mainz for about a year and a half after I finished my master's. And during that time, really got exposed to Cage, Feldman, Nan Caro, Tenney, you know, a lot of the stuff mm-hmm. that was really happening because of Ernst Albrecht Stiebler, the Hessischer Rundfunk director for their new music program at the time, or actually Bernd Leukert had taken over at that time. I don't know if these names mean anything to you, but they were really important people mm-hmm. who became important people in the book. Anyway, then, so I decided to drift towards music history, and I drifted towards American experimental music. And as I started researching that topic, in particular Feldman, Feldman was sort of my way into this because being in Germany, I realized Feldman was sort of like this god. I mean, he was just everywhere. This was in the 90s. And at the time, I mean, now in the mm-hmm. United States, Feldman is really, he's a thing now. But at that time, nobody played his music. He was not particularly well known mm-hmm. Beyond certain circles. And the other thing that was a key issue is that almost everything that had been published on Feldman at the time was in German. There was Walter Zimmermann's book.
Oh, wow.
There were these Musikkonzept books, you know, published by Heinz-Klaus Metzger. And so since I was fluent in German, I was able to actually do research on Feldman. And I just kept thinking, this is so weird. I'm an American, he's an American, there's nothing in English. And so I decided actually over the course of my PhD work to write my dissertation about Feldman in Germany. And so I knew that Feldman had first come to Germany. He had a DAAD in 1971, 1972 to Berlin. And then later in the 80s, he was at Darmstadt and just became this really big phenomenon in Germany. And so I was like, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Why am I as an American being exposed to all of this experimental American music in Germany and not at home as a music student? So I got a DAAD myself and this is when I finally came to Berlin. I mean, I'd been to Berlin before, but I moved to Berlin for a year to do my dissertation research. And during that year, I really did, all of the research for my dissertation. I traveled around, interviewed everybody I could. I did research at all the various radio stations and places that I could get access to. And what really happened was sort of serendipity, because the very first research visit I made was to the archives in Darmstadt, because I was interested in Feldman in mm-hmm. Darmstadt in particular. So I went to Darmstadt to the little villa where they have their archives, and the archivist there didn't seem all that interested in my topic, but he said, oh, you really, he said, you really need to go further back. And before, you know, I don't know, the 80s, I was like interested in the 80s. And he basically put in my hand, literally put in my hand, a gigantic binder full of newspaper clippings and press clippings about American music in Germany going back to 1945. And nobody had ever looked at this before. And so it was like, you know, Copland conducts the whatever, you know, rinky-dink symphony somewhere, and then Leonard Bernstein comes and conducts the Philharmonic. And then, you know, later on, there were sort of more sort of real experimental things creeping in. But it was this huge folder that made me realize that this history of American music in Germany went, you know, there was a backstory to why the Feldman phenomenon could happen in the 70s and 80s. And so I sort of went back to 1945, and this is where the whole issue of the zero hour sort of, for me, it was a convenient starting point. You know, I didn't want to get into the Nazi history, and there were other scholars who dealt with music during the Third Reich and all that. So I started in 1945 and just started to track down every instance I could of American music performances in West Germany. In my dissertation, just went up to 1987, I think, because that's when Feldman died, and I sort of ended my dissertation with Feldman. And then after, in the years following, once I was finished with my PhD, I did a couple more years of research and went to a number of different places I hadn't been able to go before, including WDR in Cologne and some major archives that were sort of missing from my dissertation work. And then that all of this turned into the book. And I guess I would say, Matt, you were saying that you haven't seen any other text that sort of tells the same story. And that was when I was working on my PhD, I would go to bookstores and I'd go to the music section. I would look for a book that told this story. I was looking for an explanation for why is all of this American music so present there in a way that it isn't here or wasn't at the time. I mean, now experimental music has become quite, faddish isn't the word, but it's more of a presence, you know, in the music world than it was even back in the 90s. You probably noticed this going back and forth between places like Mills and Berlin. I was trying to find an answer to my own experience as an American musician, first being exposed to this, all of this music in particular in Germany. And it's not just like the story's the same all over Europe. West Germany was really a very specific set of circumstances after the war. So that's sort of a long-winded version of how I got there.
That's really great. Yeah, thanks so much for that context. I really want to dig into some kind of like more details around this patronage, but I feel like maybe to kind of set up the conversation, although this is probably already familiar to most listeners, just in case it isn't, can you kind of explain how this American avant-garde music was kind of a break from the European music happening at the time? Like how it was, maybe why it was exciting to Europeans at that time. What did it sound like? How was it aesthetically a break or different?
Well, I guess one thing that was interesting to me in looking at things like American music in Darmstadt and just the reception. I mean, I guess the title of my dissertation was Patronage and Reception History. This isn't on the title of the book anymore, but the title of the dissertation was Patronage and Reception History of American Experimental Music in West Germany. And so this idea of reception history is something I really tracked, seeing like how were people reacting to the different music. And what I found out is, Germans weren't interested in Aaron Copland. You know, here Copland was the god of American music. Germans couldn't care less about Copland. Mm-hmm. It was boring, derivative, European sounding, nothing new. And so when somebody came along to Darmstadt in 1954 and gave a lecture about Ives, Cowell, Varese, and Partch or whoever, they were like, wow, this is something different. And so one of the things that I kind of started paying attention to historically was the German view of America as a source of newness. You know, it's just plays into all of these myths and tropes about Americans being these rugged individualists and forging their own path and blah, 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 you know, Thoreau. And I don't know if you guys know the 18th century American composer William Billings, but one of my favorite quotes from him is he said, "Nature is the best dictator." And he meant this in terms of composition in terms as a composer, you have to create your own paradigm. And so this idea, nature is the best dictator. Mm-hmm. It's a very American idea about individualism and idiosyncratic systems that are unique to individuals and this kind of thing. And so Germans really like this idea. There's quotes by Goethe and, you know, way back in the past about America being a source of newness and freshness and naivete and innocence. And, you know, we don't have the burden of history and blah, blah, blah. You know, all of this, I'm sure you get this just from being one of you being an American, you know, in Germany. And so I think that was part of it, is that just once the experimental stuff started to become known, it was like I said, Ives Cowell, I mean, Verez is an American, but he was seen as part of that scene. That was just of great interest. And then the whole thing explodes with Cage, because Cage and Tudor, when they first came, were so controversial. But the controversy, whereas here in the United States, we tend to just ignore things that we aren't interested in or things that we think are bad there. And you might also get this just from living there. There's a great virtue in arguing about things you disagree about. I mean, I think this is sort of more of a European trait in general, and really a wonderful one that has a kind of intellectual, you know, there's a kind of intellectual respect for differing opinions. And I really track that also in the reception history of Cage, that even when people hated Cage, they were willing to, you know, write about him, publish about him, fight about him, have radio broadcasts about him. And through all of this massive exposure, it just created sort of this hype that made him so present. And I found that really fascinating. And I think in the book, I have a section about when Cage and Tudor first went to Donaueschingen in 1954. You know, they did an hour-long concert. It was a matinee. It's like on a Saturday afternoon, and they did all this crazy stuff. And that performance, that hour-long matinee performance in this teeny tiny place in the middle of nowhere, that is Donaueschingen, that performance had something like 300 published reviews and in newspapers all across. Wow. 300. And I found in the in the Baden-Baden, in the SVF archives, I found about 60. I mean, I knew there had been 300 something. I don't remember the there was something like 300 reviews, and I actually found 60 of them there in their archive. And then by comparison, I think the same year or the year before, Tudor played a concert in New York City. I don't remember the venue, where he premiered, I think, Boulez's Second Sonata, Stockhausen something or other, along with stuff of Cage. In New York City, within a year, only, I think, two reviews had been published anywhere of this concert. So just that difference alone, the kind of constant bombardment of information that this is happening versus a total silence, vacuum, ignoring it that we had here in this country, was just such a stark difference that even bad press is press, you know, bad reviews at least let people know you're alive. And the worst thing is if people just ignore it and don't review it at all. So I found that really interesting, that the controversial stuff was the stuff that people were really the most interested in. And that sort of continued on after the Cage, you know, Cage in the 50s. And then in the 60s, there was kind of a backlash against that in places like Darmstadt. At the same time, his ideas had infiltrated people like Kagel and Ligeti and even Stockhausen. And so even though Cage himself wasn't in Germany for several decades, his ideas were spreading like wildfire. And then with minimalism, once minimalism hit, it was sort of the same thing. It was like deeply criticized, but also like something so stunning and different that everybody got really excited about it. Nan Caro was sort of the same thing. So it's just continued to be a trend. And like I say, I haven't really kept up with things recently, so I don't know if there are similar things happening now. I mean, it's a really different landscape because, like I said, American experimental music, or what I still refer to as American experimental music, is more, it's more present in the United States now than it used to be, especially like partly because of music programs are more aware of it. People teach, I mean, I teach seminars on Cage. Mills is, you know, a place like Mills or even Stanford, which is very conservative historically, you know, they've heard of Morton Feldman now. So anyway,
they're working on that.
No, it's true. I mean, from my perspective, it's like that. I mean, the 300 reviews of the Cage Tudor performance is jaw dropping. But on obviously a much smaller level, we can say that there's definitely something familiar to that dynamic that it's often quite strange. You know, I mean, obviously now everything's quite connected, right? So like the source of publishing isn't necessarily as important as it maybe once was, right? Like there's still linguistic barriers which ought to be acknowledged, but if something tends to be published in Europe, oftentimes in a musical context, it will actually be published in English. But we'll often have, I mean, it's really funny, like, you know, we, to some extent, I mean, we can play quite large shows in Europe, right? There's times where we'll, you know, we'll play in London, there'll be 2,000 people there. And it's very interesting to see how the work that in some senses, you know, might be understood as being quite challenging, can be appreciated and kind of discussed in this European context. And then when we talk to people in the United States, there is no awareness whatsoever that that would happen, right? Like, I think a lot of people would be shocked that we could gather 10 people in a room to listen to this music.
Yeah, even beyond kind of like audience size, what I find really interesting is this kind of discursive component that, I mean, Cage was kind of like king of that, as you're mentioning. And I feel like that's still a part of the fabric today. Like, I feel like a lot of the really in-depth interviews and kind of outlets that we have to really go deep on some of the research that we're doing are very kind of European-centric outlets. And then often in the US, there's not really a lot of context for that kind of work. So it's really interesting how that's kind of maintained.
One thing I was just going to say is that it is surprising that the United States and, you know, Central Europe are still so far apart, even with all of this connectivity. And about, I don't know, it must have been now 15 years ago, I went to a conference in England at the University of Sussex. It was this group called the International Society of 20th Century Music or something. And I went there and gave a paper and I met a lot of scholars, but there were a lot of American scholars there and a lot of British scholars and a lot of Central European scholars. And I loved being in that environment in England where they were taking the musicologists there and the composers were really getting the best of both worlds. They were getting what was happening in the United States. They're getting what was happening in Europe and they were doing their own thing at the same time. And I just thought that was really, it was really invigorating to see albeit a very small society there in England of new music people, that they were really paying attention to all sides. I mean, by necessity, I guess, because they're on a small island. But it was really exciting to see people who understood both contexts, you know, to some degree. And I think that's missing both here and in Europe to some degree, yeah.
Would you say that it's fair to say that without this kind of German patronage at that time, that this kind of, if we want to call it like the avant-garde period, do you think it would be as canonized as it is today if it wasn't for this kind of patronage support from West Germany?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, what might have been. I don't know. I mean, the other part of how I ended up doing what I was doing with my dissertation is when I wrote my dissertation proposal, I had this one footnote. I always come back to this footnote where I said something like, many composers and groups and musicians have had work published, commissioned, premiered, recorded, written about, blah, 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 in West Germany. And then I gave this list that went through all of these different things, lectures by Cage that had been published in Germany, piece, you know, I don't know if you guys know who Carla Bley is, but Carla Bley's monumental jazz opera Escalator Over the Hill, which was never ever performed live ever until somebody did it in Cologne about 15 years ago. You know, why is this American, gigantic American work from 1968, you know, 30 years later being produced in Germany? And so I sort of had this footnote that just listed all of these things that would not have that had maybe they would have eventually showed up here in some form, but the fact that they were having, mm-hmm. I have an article that quotes Alvin Curran, who was also somebody who really benefited from all of this European support. And he said in an interview with me, he said, it was a place, a place to ply our wares with dignity. So this idea of plying our wares being like, not like salespeople, but somebody who has something to offer and not having a marketplace to be able to offer it. Mm-hmm. And to be able to offer it, not just offer it and make money, but to offer it with this idea of dignity, like to be able to do it. And that comes back to this sort of intellectual culture of disagreement, argument, discussion, seeing other people's viewpoints, this kind of thing that is so discouraged in American culture, you know, even more today than usual, but typically people sort of avoid trying to disagree.
Yeah. And in a sense, before we run away and talk about the works themselves, I just want to set some kind of a foundation for listeners who might not be familiar with the history of this. So when, who was it who was talking about plying their wares? Alvin Curran. Okay. So how much, and I'm sure it's a combination of the two, but where did this source of funding come from, and what kind of programs were started in order to facilitate that kind of work in the early formation of West Germany? And I guess the second question to that is, when we talk about a vibrant intellectual discourse and culture, and a culture that, with an appetite for debate, how much of that debate indeed was being seeded by, you know, maybe an American interest in funding culture in the newly formed country of West Germany, and how much of that can just be attributed to, you know, general European historical interest in these topics. But I think before we run away, it would be really good to know what the source of that funding was, you know, and maybe what the intentionality was there in putting that in place.
Well, that's also a really big, complicated question. That reminds me just of a little...
that's a good one.
It reminds me of a little anecdote. When I was getting ready to try to publish the book in question, New Music, New Allies, I had sent it to Richard Taruskin, who's a famous musicologist who used to teach at Berkeley, and he was the series editor of the University of California Press, publishing the series that ended up publishing the book. And he suggested early on that I should title the book Where the Money Was, which I thought was sort of facetious.
Yes.
You know, I said, no, I'm not going to call it that. But his point was, this is sort of what it was about. And it makes it sound like these composers were just running after money, which if you read the book, you'll see that, I mean, I outlined how much Cage and Tudor made when they came to Germany in 1954. It was a very, very small amount of money, but it was comparatively larger than anything they would have gotten for doing a concert, you know, in the West Village in 1954 or something like that. So, but the question of where the money came from, I'm not going to say it came from the CIA. People always want to hear that. They want to believe it. And in fact,
we'll get there.
Everybody, I found no evidence of that. I've said it again and again, and nothing in my book turned up any evidence of that. I mean, what I did track quite carefully, or as carefully as I could, was how the occupation, the American occupation of the American zone, the American zone territories, which included, you know, Frankfurt and Darmstadt and, you know, Stuttgart, Baden-Württemberg, that area in Hessen, how the American military occupation interacted with music culture in the late 40s. And there was some money put into places like Darmstadt, you know, small, a couple thousand dollars put into scholarships and things like this. And there were these people called music officers who were military employees who were actually civilians. They were not, army soldiers. And I tracked down some of these. The interesting thing is that a lot of these people were composers who fell into this sort of civilian military role. They were either called music officers or cultural officers. And so even more than the money, they were there to sort of just keep an eye on what was happening. And what I didn't find, and this is the thing where, like, you guys cited Francis Stoner Saunders' book, Who Paid the Piper, about, you know, about the visual art world and the sort of a parallel history with the abstract expressionism. And I did not find evidence of this kind of behind the scenes manipulating, you know, like the State Department is secretly trying to infiltrate Germany with the bombshell of John Cage or something like that. I did not find evidence of that. What I really found was the power of individuals, both these American military officers who were composers themselves and had an understanding of music, but also the individuals, the German individuals who were put in place in these different institutions like Darmstadt, Donaueschingen, the radio stations, all of which were set up to be autonomous and not have a centralized kind of over, you know, like the BBC or in France, from what little I know about it, you know, kind of, or even NPR, you know, a kind of centralized national radio. Germany wanted to, or the occupying forces wanted to have Germany not have, for obvious reasons, to have a kind of centralized
voice. Makes a lot of sense.
And so, but what that meant is that all of these little towns, I mean, little towns like Hamburg and Bremen and Cologne had their own radio stations with their own new music director. More often than not, that music director was a composer with ideas of their own. So if that composer, like Hans Otte at Radio Bremen, fell in love with John Cage, you're going to get a whole lot of John Cage there and nobody can stop him. You know, that kind of autonomy seemed to be so unique. And so even though there weren't large amounts of money, the money that there was being funneled really in an autonomous way by individuals who made those decisions and were really not, as far as I can tell, for quite some long period of time, not accountable to anybody. And that started really early on, especially in Cologne, with some new music programs there where people started, there was a late night program that started doing some programs about Cage and other American experimental music. And people wanted to, I mean, there's the whole propaganda part about it with the other part of it with the America houses and the Ford Foundation and that kind of thing, which is a better known story about the American occupation trying to democratize.
Let's yeah. talk about that. No, I think that's it. Is that in a sense that and I'll speak maybe just to Saunders' book in a second. It's really trying to get down to because I mean basically from the Saunders' book. Another, I think in the email exchange we spoke about, you know, we have a relationship here with a great institution, an old institution here called Haus der Kultur in der Welt, which is, you know, basically an institution that dates back to this period that was set up to promote a very international view of culture on John Dulles Avenue, no less, right? It appears that, you know, even if in this particular instance and with your particular research, there seems to be no direct ties between, say, Cage and the CIA or whatnot.
Right.
To be fair to Saunders, I don't think in any of the research in the Congress for Cultural Freedom, there's ever really an allegation that many of the artists were, in a sense, directly patronized by the CIA, right? Like there's a lot of stories of funds being set up in a foundation going through into an institution in Germany that is there to foster.
Well, in this period, but this happens later, we'll get into.
Sure. But there's not many direct allegations there of say direct or even conscious receiving of funds. Mm-hmm. However, it is really interesting to establish a context that, you know, there were many different soft power initiatives happening at the time. And it's also very interesting, at least for my curiosity, to understand, were these soft power initiatives being put in place because there was not yet an appetite in Germany for American art and ideas? Or what kind of role did these institutions have in fomenting or somewhat, you know, satisfying an emerging appetite for? I mean, this is a chicken and egg question.
Yeah, I guess we're trying to like dig down to how organic did this kind of community form, and like what were the kind of inner workings of it that made it possible?
Exactly, because in the other reading, so Saunders's argument on this is that actually these soft power initiatives were very much kind of in anticipation of you know, or in response to the early Cold War. Mm-hmm. And they were also in response, in a sense, to this idea that Germans were very skeptical of American culture, actually.
Yes.
That they believe that they came from kind of a higher culture, and they had, you know, this crazy legacy of mm-hmm. European classical music and so on and so forth. And so the soft power initiatives, in a sense, were used as a way to kind of promote that America could also have, or also did have, this like a vibrant intellectual culture that could compete with Russian ideas at the time.
Right,
but we don't have to get too much into it. But I think establishing somewhat of an awareness of the institutional kind of universe is really good for people who might not have any idea what the climate was at the time.
Yeah, right. That's good.
Well, I guess what I would say to that is that there's sort of two stories in my view happening simultaneously. It seems like there's a kind of parallel story where on the one hand you have these sort of official institutional efforts on the part of the Americans, and that includes these things called the America houses. America houses were they were little houses. They were usually villas that had been, I guess, sequestered by the occupation forces in towns all over Germany. I have a couple of photographs in the book of some of them. And these were places where people could go and hear lectures on American culture. They often had lending libraries. They had records and scores. Some of the pictures I have pictures of, you know, Burl Ives and Marian Anderson and, I don't know, Louis Armstrong, and people who were representing, as you say, this diversity of American culture, which is distinctive and equal to European culture, yet very different in heritage. And that was definitely a kind of Cold War mm-hmm. propaganda effort to, first of all, diversify culture in Germany, so it wasn't Germanic-centered anymore, but also, as you say, to compete against the Soviet Union in the early days of the Cold War. And then the Ford Foundation, which I believe really got going in the early 60s, just pumped tons of money into sending people, especially to Berlin. And then, you know, the DAD, the Künstler Program, which a lot of people benefited from going to Berlin. These were really deliberate efforts to diversify the culture in very official ways. What really was fascinating to me is seeing that how early on those official efforts, like State Department tours. I have a musicologist friend who's written a whole book about cultural diplomacy. You should probably talk to her about this. Cultural diplomacy during the Cold War and the State Department tours and that kind of thing.
Sounds good.
She's sort of an expert on this. But so early on, they would send the State Department or whoever would send Copeland or Leonard Bernstein or Roy Harris or all of these neoclassical, what I would call neoclassical composers, they would send them to Europe or to Germany. And there was, mm-hmm. there just wasn't any interest in it. It fell flat. It was, I mean, people went, you know, Bernstein conducted Munich and I'm sure it was a sold out show, but there was no sort of resonance. And so the parallel story that I was tracking was how these other sort of like under the radar things, like even like Darmstadt, although I did find some sort of military document that recommended that GIs go to Darmstadt to the Ferienkurse during their vacation to like take in the music. And the thought of all these wow. American GIs like going to Darmstadt listening to Stockhausen Boulez was just so bizarre to me. But the fact that this appetite within the new music community developed an appetite for something that wasn't the official stuff that the United States wanted to send. It was the stuff the United States government didn't even know existed that actually took hold. And that that's why this question about the official propaganda stuff didn't interest me as much, because it was not sort of validating the story that I was tracking, if that makes sense.
What was the kind of makeup of these early audiences? Like, who was going to these performances? And, you know, you said that there was an audience of, I can't remember what size, it was maybe it was a small audience, and you said there were 300 articles written or something like this. Like, who was making up that audience largely?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Donau Eschingen had been established before the war. I don't remember now. I think it was established in the 20s. And so it was sort of a known entity. It was sort of more of an official culture kind of thing, but also kind of a high class culture situation, as far as I can tell. You know, it had a lot of connections to France. The guy who ran Donaueschingen at the time, Heinrich Strobel, had a lot of connections to Boulez and to French culture. And he first brought Musique Concrète there in 1953. And so I have the feeling that those audience, and actually there's a recording I could send you, a recording of Cage and Tudor performing in Donaueschingen. And then you can hear the audience sort of laughing and whistling. And at some point somebody yells, "Silence!" Somebody yells "Silence!" And then somebody else yells "Pourquoi?" Like they're saying, "Be quiet, listen." And the other thing people are saying, "Well, why should we listen?" And you can hear this sort of uproar, and it, you know, that it was controversial. But the fact that these sort of high class, snooty audiences, you know, sitting in this castle, sipping champagne or whatever, are listening to this crazy music, and then that really started this wildfire. I think that's kind of interesting that it almost didn't matter who the audience was. If the, I don't know, I keep using the word resonance, if the after effects, the ripple effects of that one event were handled in the right way. And so, but I've also heard from, I mentioned this night, the night program in Cologne in the 50s, I heard from people like Dieter Schnabel and others who were young people at the time in the post-war era, just staying up late at night, just hungry to hear anything new, just like starved for anything new, regardless of where it came from. And so I think that had a huge effect on that generation of composers born, I guess he was probably born in the mid-30s, you know, for those people. Young people in the post-war era, they were staying up late at night listening. They were flocking to Darmstadt and to these other places. And then later on in the 60s, there started to be other kinds of what I call alternative venues, like Mary Bauermeister's studio concerts in Cologne, which was a very much of a sort of underground alternative scene that wasn't sort of general audiences.
Can you just explain who she is as a figure and, you know, her relationships?
Mary Bauermeister was an artist who was known as an artist but is generally well known in music circles because she was the partner of Stockhausen for some period of time. I don't know how early they were connected, but they were partners in the 60s. I think they broke up around 1968. But she lived in Cologne and she had a studio, sort of an attic. There's actually a wonderful book that documents it, a German book that documents actually the whole scene in Cologne during this period, but documents the activities there. And this also brings in Fluxus.
I have that book. It's really amazing.
So this also brought kind of Fluxus entered into this whole story because the Fluxus people were sort of picking up a lot of Cage's ideas, but taking them somewhere new. So Nam June Paik and all these people were involved. And so there's famous incidences that happened in Mary Bauermeister's studio concerts, which just became another place where people were exposed to a lot of the more radical stuff in this was the early 60s, I guess. Her things were happening, I think, between 1960 and 62. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you have people like Walter Zimmermann, also in Cologne, starting something called the Beginner Studio, which was also sort of an alternative venue. So I was sort of looking at the institutional things like the radio stations and the festivals, and then these sort of private independent things that were happening sort of a little bit more under the radar, but also getting a lot of support from the radio stations. I mean, Walter Zimmermann's Beginner Studio was an independent venue, but he got support from Reinhard Urschlegel at Deutschlandfunk or whatever it was called back then. So many of the radio stations have changed names in recent years. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so even these alternative venues had support from the because the people at the radio stations were paying attention, or particular individuals like Urschlegel or Ernst Albrecht Stiebler and others.
It's interesting hearing you talk about some of these kind of early happenings and events, because I feel like this time has been so canonized and romanticized in kind of today's composer's mind. And I want to get to this concept of the zero hour for a minute. Sometimes the zero hour is like this post kind of zero hour period is idealized as a kind of phoenix rising from the ashes. And it almost feels like this kind of burden on contemporary composers to kind of compete with this idealized historicization of this time period. You've been critical of this kind of view of that. Can you just define for us what the zero hour means, and then, you know, how you feel about this kind of maybe romanticization of that period?
Yeah, I mean, the zero hour obviously means the moment World War II ended in Germany in May 1945, and this idea, like you say, the phoenix rising from the ashes, the rubble, clearing the rubble, you know, rebuilding the buildings. I mean, when I was living in Berlin in the 90s, there was still rubble everywhere. I mean, I lived in Friedrichshain, which was just still a total, a mess. In fact, the last time I was in Berlin, the street I lived in was still looked exactly like it had probably in 1950. Zero hour. It wasn't so much that I was critical of it as that I was trying to draw attention to the work of other scholars like Pamela Potter and Michael Cotter, and, you know, people who had studied music in the Third Reich era, and then to some degree showed the continuities into the 40s and the late 40s and the 50s, that the zero, they were really the ones who exposed the fact that the zero hour was a myth. It's not just like every fascist musicologist rolled up and disappeared. You know, they became editors of major magazines. And I have another musicologist friend who also knows quite a bit more about this than I do, about this, the lingering of people, musicologists who had been very involved in fascist ideology, who continued to be employed in the post-war era. And so I was just trying to sort. I can give you some other names of people who might be interesting for you to talk to. But that was just sort of a little tangent in my book. I don't get into it all that much, other than to sort of just acknowledge that it wasn't a black and white ending and beginning, but that there were people who, you know, obviously people who lived through the Third Reich continued to be active afterwards, and that it's a little bit of a fallacy to call it a really clear beginning. On the other hand, it really was a beginning. I mean, the radio station, the system of the radio stations, the way they were set up, was very new. The way the festivals were connected to the radio stations, the way all of these things were interconnected. I have quite a section in the early part of the book that tries to explain the network system of the radio stations, and how, even though they're all autonomous, they're interconnected. So they support each other. They're not just competing. They're actually supporting each other. And this, the way that they can make recordings in-house and then share them with each other, it's a really brilliant system. And I was just going to say something else. Oh, and the other part of this, which is maybe also tangent, but is related, is this, the notion of the Bildungsauftrag. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but this was a mandate for the radio stations to educate the public in some way. So Bildung, means, what does it mean? It means to be educated, gebildet, to be gebildet. And so the Bildungsauftrag meant that the radio stations had an obligation to be pedagogical in some way.
Right.
Thus, they didn't just play a piece of John Cage's and then play a piece by Beethoven. They would play a piece by John Cage and then they would discuss it for a half an hour. And then they play it again the next night. And then they play it again a week later. So they were actually educating and not just entertaining. And that's a huge difference between American radio and German radio at the time.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, certain State Department concert series that you said fell flat. And America has this idea of promoting or giving a platform to certain jazz artists from the United States at the time. There's an incredible piece. I don't know if you've ever seen it. There's an artist here called Michaela Melian. She was once a member of the Neue Deutsche Welle group, FSK. But she did a piece, an art piece a couple of years ago where she actually invited a bunch of people into an old America house. I forget where it was. And you were able to play jazz records from boxes that still had State Department stamps on them.
Wow.
So you're able to like pick them up and stick them on. It was really, really cool piece. It's a shame. It certainly wasn't in Berlin because I would have attended.
Wow.
But clearly, I mean, at least what that piece signaled to me was this idea, and we can send you the link afterwards because it's fun, but like signaled to me was that there was, whether or not the these kind of State Department tours were a success, however one might gauge that, There appears to at least be a link there between, or an attempt to seed, again, certain developments that were happening in jazz music in the United States within wider German discourse. And I just wonder if in your research you've encountered this, because obviously anecdotally, and certainly not being an expert of jazz myself, it also appears that there, at least in the contemporary setting, there is a similar parallel arrangement in place where European-funded arts festivals are inarguably like a main source or a major source of support for American jazz musicians. And so I wonder if that parallel ever came up in your research.
Oh yeah, it does. And I mean, I guess I just preface what I'll say about jazz with saying that, you know, we're talking about really huge broad topics. And so when I talk about audiences or reception, it's, you know, it's very reductive by necessity. And I think that you'd get a different kind of story if you were studying the audiences of the Berlin Philharmonic in 1965, who were maybe hearing American composers' works, as opposed to the more sort of experimental venues. I was looking at really contemporary music, avant-garde music audiences. So there's a different story, you know, there's different stories to be told. What I totally agree with is that let's just stick with Germany, the way West Germany during this period promoted jazz was also, yes, very different from the United States. I mean, the famous story, of course, has to do with Paris, that so many African-American jazz artists moved to Paris for lengthy periods of time because they could have a career there. They could get paid well. They were treated well. I mean, that's a whole nother story about France's relationship to African-Americans, you know, goes way back also to the World War I era. It's really interesting, different story. But sure, the jazz festivals in Germany really brought over all sorts, especially from the 60s on, brought over a lot of more avant-garde jazz artists. They started having jazz as part of the Donaueschingen Festival, I think in 1966 or 67. I have a section in the book about that. So the jazz, and there was a very, actually a wonderful person who was involved with SVF and Donaueschingen, who made this famous statement I just loved. And he said, jazz too is contemporary music. So this idea that we have to include it in these festivals of contemporary music was really a revolutionary idea. And then everything explodes in the 70s when you start having, you know, free jazz next to gamelan, next to minimalism, next to Tangerine Dream, next to, you know, whatever, all of this stuff being seen as part of one world music. But also the idea of, I'll say two other things about this. One is that I did a lot of kind of demographic research early on. I don't think much of it ended up in the book, but I was trying to find studies about audiences in Germany during this period. And one thing that I found very well documented was that people who were interested in what we would call contemporary classical avant-garde experimental music, those audiences were also equally interested in avant-garde jazz and free jazz and all of that kind of stuff post Ornette Coleman. So that there was a very, this was validated actually by my time when I was in Mainz and living in the Frankfurt area. I would meet people. I mean, I first heard of Nancarrow while I was living in Mainz, and the people who told me about Nan Caro also told me about Ornette Coleman, you know, and about Sun Ra and about the Art Ensemble of Chicago and all this stuff mm-hmm. I had also never encountered in the United States as a classical mm-hmm. pianist. And so this interest that sort of went across the board into all things avant-garde certainly included jazz. And it was also validated in my research about Carla Bley, who's a composer who I wrote a book about. And she hardly ever performs in the United States. She's been active since 1958. I don't think she's toured in the United States in decades, yet she won a German jazz trophy about 3 years ago or something. She was given a national award from Germany mm-hmm. as like the best jazz artist in the world or something in 2003 or whatever. And as I mentioned, also her gigantic work called Escalade Over the Hill was produced in Cologne, of all places. Not in the United States. She's lived in New York State since mm-hmm. the 50s. I mean, she's a major figure who has almost no presence here yet. You know, you run into anybody in Germany, they'll know who she is. So that's even today, that is still quite striking for jazz artists. And it's sad, you know, because it also goes back to this idea that the State Department was promoting things that it was not supporting at home. This is the other thing that really struck me, and I think also, you know, especially in the middle of the civil rights movement, the State Department was sending all these African, I mean, this is sort of a tangent, but, you know, mm-hmm. it's a well-known story. The State Department sending all these African Americans all over the world to show how wonderful American culture is, yet at home they're beating them to death on the streets. And so this kind of hypocrisy is also, I think, is now very sort of obvious to audiences on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you bring that up. I was actually reading a Time Magazine article that I'll link to in the show notes about this, how, you know, the U.S. was kind of embarrassed at the bad PR they were getting for their horrible treatment of African-Americans at home. And so they went on this kind of like diplomacy cultural exchange tour where they were sending jazz musicians out. And so Dave Brubeck and Louis Armstrong ended up writing a piece called Who's the Real Ambassador? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've come across that work.
I think I've heard of it. I don't think I've read it.
It's pretty wild. The lyrics.
It's a musical.
It's a musical. Oh. Yeah, right. And yeah, so it's basically they're
it's like a lampoon. Uh-huh.
It's a lampoon. Yeah. They are, you know, pointing out the paradox and the hypocrisy, and they're also, you know, there's this kind of fantasy that that Louis Armstrong is kind of seen as the real ambassador, and that there's some kind of like mix up, and yeah, it's kind of a almost comedic in a way, a dealing of a very serious issue. Wow. But yeah,
the quotes are really funny. The lyrics are amazing. No commodity is quite so strange as this thing we call cultural exchange.
That's great.
The State Department has discovered jazz. It reaches folks like nothing ever has.
Yeah. So good.
Sung by Louis Armstrong.
You're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. Thank you.